Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Advice to listeners before we get going. There is a swear word that was used once or twice in this episode.
Yeah, I don't think it's anything that most people are going to find too jarring. But if you have kids in the car with you or other sensitive ears in your location, you might want to be advised.
Okay, let's start with a quote from our guest, Jonathan Rauch. He writes, "Acquiring knowledge is a conversation, not a destination. It's a process, a journey we take together, not alone. Others are always involved, and knowledge is not something I have. More fundamentally, it's something we have."
This is such an important concept that our sense of the world, our knowledge of the world, is something that's shaped through a good faith effort of trying to establish facts, then challenging those facts to make sure they really hold up, discussing them, and allowing our understanding of the world to evolve. And this is a process that today, I worry, might be under threat.
The Constitution of Knowledge with Jonathan Rauch.
The Constitution of Knowledge, the reality-based community that it sets up, this global network of people hunting for each other's errors, is far and away the greatest human technology ever invented. This is the only way to make knowledge that can create a global conversation of people looking for truth and more especially looking for error.
Our show is about fixes.
Yeah, how to make the world a better place.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
Richard, I think you and I both agree that the health of American democracy and that in some other countries is threatened by all kinds of things. These disinformation tactics, trolling, conspiracy theories, cancel culture, various efforts to undermine the marketplace of ideas and really attack the social rules that underline our ability to turn our disagreements into knowledge.
It's easy to blame social media for the often crazy attacks on knowledge and what we understand collectively as truth, but the causes of these attacks are complex, and that's what we're going to consider today.
Jonathan Rauch is the author of the excellent new book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. The author, as many of you know, many books, and a really sterling example of what it means to be a public intellectual today.
Thanks for joining us, Jonathan, on How Do We Fix It? First, what is the Constitution of Knowledge?
Well, thank you so much for having me to begin with. And yeah, that's the big new idea of the book, is that we have a Constitution of Knowledge. That is the system that we in America and people who care about truth around the world rely on to keep us anchored to reality and to turn our disagreements into facts. And it is the only system known to mankind that can do those two things.
Is this a network? Just explain this a little bit more.
So the best way I find to explain this is to just back up one step and talk about what the problem is that it's solving. Every society, large or small, needs to figure out whether certain things are true or false for public purposes. And historically, the way they've done that is that they divide into sects, each of which believing its own separate truth, and they go to war, or they appoint a priest or a prince or a politburo who oppresses everyone and says, here's what you have to believe. So they usually wind up at war with each other or going down rabbit holes of false belief and ignorance and oppression reign. And that's the first 200,000 years of human history.
And then what happened?
About 350 years ago, around the same time that the ideas behind the U.S. Constitution were floated, similar ideas came up for knowledge, which is instead of having rulers, let's have rules. Let's say the only way you can really claim to know something is by running it through all these rules, all these other people who are going to have to check you. You're going to have to persuade them that you're right. Other people are going to try to persuade them that you're wrong. Only what comes out of that process, all those institutions, all those checks and balances, that's going to be knowledge. And that turns out to solve the same kind of problem that the U.S. Constitution does, which is taking a very diverse society and creating a system in which people can bargain, negotiate, reach some kinds of consensus about law on the one hand and truth on the other.
So in that period, in the 17th and 18th century, we had these world-changing revolutions in terms of the scientific revolution and the idea that facts had to be based on some kind of test or empiricism. We had an economic revolution with the development of markets, and we had a political revolution with the modern ideas of democracy. We're all the beneficiaries of that. And do you feel like today maybe people don't appreciate it? Some of those very systems and traditions and norms that helped establish all these wonderful things are now under attack.
We got complacent, in a word, Jim. The system worked so well for so long that we took it for granted. We developed this notion that if you ask Americans where knowledge comes from, where truth comes from, they're more than likely to say the marketplace of ideas. And the notion there is that free speech, if you let it go, will just automatically produce truth because it'll go into this marketplace and the best ideas will prevail. Well, it turns out that's not how it happens. You need the free speech, but it's only the input, because if you leave people in an unstructured environment to believe whatever they feel like believing, they'll believe stuff that's fun to believe, that increases their status in their group or that flatters their ego, and the situation turns into QAnon. They go into their rabbit holes and we're back where we started. So there are all kinds of rules that you need. Things like you have to check your statements and you have to do it in ways that work for anybody, not just people who agree with you. There are all kinds of institutions. These are everything from universities, academic journals, research institutes, to newsrooms. I'm a journalist, like the newsroom that taught me you have to check everything. It has to be edited. You sure it's right? Then it's going to be checked by other journalists. The law is another big one. Donald Trump found out that when he took spurious claims to court, they got thrown out because they weren't factual. Courts find facts. And the fourth big pillar, what I call the reality-based community, is government, which also has to be fact-based. And that's like the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the weather report that Donald Trump tried to change. So you need all of that stuff. You need to understand it's there. You need to maintain it and understand it, and especially defend it when it comes under attack, as it is right now.
And we're also dealing now with information warfare, which are attacks on knowledge?
Yeah. Yeah, people have understood from time immemorial, since Plato's day, that you can manipulate the social and media environment for political gain, confuse people about what to believe, or shame them so that they think it's wrong to believe something that may be true. And by manipulating people in that way, you can gain a lot of power. So we've hit a period when we're seeing major outbreaks of two different kinds of social manipulation. One is primarily from the right, that's disinformation, conspiracy theories, what's called the fire hose of falsehood. That's where you put out so many lies, half-truths, and conspiracy theories so fast that the media can't keep up with them, refuting them, and the public doesn't know what to believe anymore, or who to believe. And then the other is the use of social coercion. That's an old tactic, but it's so much easier now with social media. So the left was the first to pick up on the use of what's now called canceling, social coercion, using these new tools. And the right was the first to pick up on the use of Russian-style disinformation. That's, you know, Steve Bannon, advisor to Trump, as he put it, flood the zone with shit. Sorry, I guess it's an R-rated podcast now. But it's just important to emphasize that these are just tools. They're not ideological. They can be used by the left, the right, Nazis, Leninists, Putin, Trump, cancelers, CRT. Anybody can use them.
Another factor, you mentioned the big debate over critical race theory. It seems like that's part of a trend that we are seeing on both the right and the left, to see ourselves primarily as parts of groups, as tribe. But you cite some really interesting research that once you start seeing yourself as primarily as this member of a tribe, opposed to other tribes, it really affects your ability to think clearly and rationally.
Yeah, you get into what I call zombie science. And that's where if all you're talking to are people who agree with you, then you feel like you're putting your beliefs out for checking and disconfirmation. But everyone you talk to thinks the same thing you do. And we can't see our own biases. That's been well established. We don't even think we have bias. We all think the other person's biased, but not us. So the only way this works is you have to have a lot of diverse viewpoints. And then you have to require people to do the last thing they feel like doing, which is submit their own viewpoints to people with very different viewpoints, often antagonistic viewpoints. That's where knowledge comes from. People will go to great lengths to avoid that. One study found they'd rather have root canal work than encounter political views they disagree with.
I love this simple sentence in The Constitution of Knowledge, which says, acquiring knowledge is a conversation, not a destination.
This is the great invention of The Constitution of Knowledge. Maybe I'm biased, but I claim that the Constitution of Knowledge, the reality-based community that it sets up, this global network of people hunting for each other's errors, is far and away the greatest human technology ever invented. It took us from tribes of small groups that advanced knowledge almost zero in 200,000 years to analyzing the COVID-19 genome in days, organizing scientists, researchers, almost overnight to do this work. So the key to this transformational technology is that everyone can enter a global conversation with anyone about an idea. I can float a hypothesis in an article I write, and someone who's living in Ethiopia, speaks an entirely different language, can write a counterpoint. If I do research, people around the world with other views can weigh in. This is the only way to make knowledge that can create a global conversation of people looking for truth, and more especially looking for error, because that's really what we're doing. We're all hunting for each other's mistakes. And that's where truth comes from.
And you said that the system has to be depersonalized and decentralized and rules-based. Can you explain how that works in journalism, science, and other fields?
Well, that's really the key to the whole enterprise. Anybody can check a statement that they believe or propound by saying, I heard it from God, or I feel it in my gut, or it ought to be true, or my friend told me, or it's what we as a group believe. That's just not going to get you to truth because you won't spot your errors. So it turns out that as with the US Constitution, you need checks and balances. You need institutions and structures that incentivize people to behave in certain ways. So in the US Constitution, for example, if you want to make a law and use state power, you're going to have to persuade members of Congress in two chambers to pass it, a president to sign it, courts to uphold it, factions to support it. It's going to change along the way because those other people and organizations will all have a say. And that's the whole point of the system. It's to bring all of those minds and all of those factions to bear. So the result at the end of the day may not be exactly what any of us started with, but will be acceptable to society. So Constitution of Knowledge, exact same thing. It's not just a figure of speech. It's not just a metaphor. It's really a social system doing the same thing. And it says, you know, if Richard or Jim want to make knowledge, they can't just say it. They can't just believe it. They're going to have to submit it to this global network of people and institutions that are checking. They're going to have to know the rules for that. like you're going to have to know how to write an academic article, if that's what your specialty is. Show you know what you're doing. Show you're familiar with the field. Make an evidence-based argument using experiments that are replicable or using arguments that will work no matter what culture you come from. And then other people are going to have at you. And it can take 10 or 20 years to move through this system.
Well, here's my journalistic pushback. You talk about years. I mean, I have deadlines every day. I mean, stories are written for, you know, the current news cycle. How does this apply to journalism as opposed to, say, the law, which does often move slowly, or science, where it can be a long process of discovery?
It can be slow in science, but remember, when we need it to be fast, it can be super fast. The COVID-19 genome was cracked within 10 days, and the vaccine was designed, first vaccine, basically over a weekend. Journalism, I'm a journalist. My first job, Winston-Salem Journal, North Carolina. I was a beat reporter. And you quickly learn that even if you're in a hurry, you have to be accurate. You're going to have to pass through an editor who is going to ask you some pretty tough questions if the thing doesn't be credible. Say, I need to look at your notes here. Did you call so-and-so? Then you're going to go through a copy desk if it's a magazine. Or increasingly now online publications, you're going to be fact-checked by someone who's going to say, produce your sources. Now that can be done in hours, not years, but those are all gates that you're going to have to go through that pass the skeptical scrutiny of others in the system. And then something else you know. When it goes into print, if you're wrong, other people are going to find that out. They'll either write letters or they'll get online or some other outlet will try to do a follow and say, wait a minute, Davies and Meggs, they completely botched the story. You know, maybe it's the Wuhan lab release story about coronavirus. The key in all of these fields isn't how fast or slow they move. It's that they're all basically hunting for errors and holding themselves accountable to the other people in the system for their mistakes. That's the magic formula, fast or slow.
Speaking of the need to check our facts, one troubling example last year and earlier this year was the unwillingness of much of the media to report on or take seriously the Wuhan lab leak theory about the origins of COVID. Is that an example of eroding standards in journalism?
Well, I don't know about eroding. I worry about journalism because finding facts is so expensive and so painstaking, and writing opinions and spouting half-truths and tweeting is very, very cheap and collects eyeballs. I, unlike a lot of people, actually, I disagree with those who see the Wuhan lab reporting as a black eye to journalism. When you go back and look at it, actually, a lot of outlets did not misreport it. Some did, many did not. And the most important thing is that why did that hypothesis resurface months later? It was because accomplished mainstream journalists at places like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times stayed on the story, watched it, said, hey, wait a minute, maybe we went too fast. Here's some evidence. Look at what these academics are saying. They resurfaced it. They brought it back. And now we're having kind of an almost festival of journalistic navel gazing to figure out how we got it so wrong. Well, that's the system actually working. The revolution in human affairs that is the constitution of knowledge, it says, you know what? Everyone makes mistakes, and it shouldn't be the end of your career if you just have a hypothesis and it's wrong. As long as you hold yourself accountable, you print the correction, you come back and get it right, that means your errors, your mistakes become fuel for further learning.
This is How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
We're speaking with Jonathan Rauch, author of the brand new book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Another threat to the constitution of knowledge is what you call emotional safetyism, something you say that's become much more common in the past 5 or 6 years.
That's the notion that hurtful words are a form of violence, make us literally unsafe. Well, that means that science and learning are a form of violence because they're based on criticism, telling us things that we don't want to hear. Seeing that leach not only into journalism, but it's very common in academia, it's increasingly common in the corporate environment. That is not a good thing, because the idea that we're supposed to stay safe from alternative hypotheses and views that may offend us because they're novel seem wrongheaded. Maybe they're right, though. I'm a campaigner for same-sex marriage, a fight that seemed hopeless back when I started in the mid-90s. And one reason for that is everyone thought that people saying what I was saying were just crazy, that it was insupportable. Well, sometimes facts that come in from the margins of society, from people who are actually deemed pariahs, turn out to be right. So it concerns me a lot when we see the inroads into journalism of emotional safetyism. You know, journalism is not a field for people who want to be safe from different ideas and different people and challenging situations. It is a job for people whose job it is to encounter those situations.
Let's, before we go, talk about solutions. What are some things that we should look at differently that are not being discussed in the public square today nearly as much as they should be?
Well, there is an elephant in the room. I think it's the biggest single threat out there, at least in America, to the constitution of knowledge. Many people are reluctant to talk about it the way it should be talked about because it sounds, frankly, so partisan. I am center-right. I have voted for many Republicans. But what we have seen in the last 5 years under Donald J. Trump and his MAGA movement is unprecedented in American politics, and that's the adaptation to American politics of mass Russian-style disinformation tactics. That happened throughout his presidency with, you know, the dizzying number of falsehoods that he spawned, conspiracy theories. But it really takes off. It goes to the next level and Stop the Steal. And it has succeeded in persuading 70% of Republicans that the election was stolen, and a plurality of independents that it might have been stolen. And this is being done on purpose. This is not just something, you know, we're walking along one day, our institutions failed us, working class wages dropped, so it was bound to happen. This is deliberate. This is a massive Russian-style disinformation campaign. So we need to be square with ourselves that we're under an epistemic attack. It's coming from the heart of our domestic political system. We got to wise up about that. So that's an important thing to do. Another thing that we need to do that's starting actually to happen on the canceling side is counter-mobilize. The cancelers, as we call them now, were the first innovators to really understand the potential of digital media to run campaigns to shame and ostracize people, to smear their reputations, to get them fired from their jobs, to make them radioactive to their friends, and they used it. The key there is to counter-organize, to begin providing support for individuals who get hit with these tactics, to provide them with legal remedies, with counseling, but most important, with comrades, people who say, we are here with you, we are standing up for you. And that is starting to happen. We've seen an outpouring just in the last few months of new groups that are beginning to do that work. Everything from the Academic Freedom Alliance, a kind of NATO for academic freedom, to the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism, which is pushing back in the schools and trying to develop an anti-racist curriculum that is not about racial essentialism, and much more in that vein.
You talk about the kind of targeted disinformation, Russian style, that has been applied in politics in recent years. And doesn't that kind of go hand in hand with an academic movement going back decades? I mean, I went to college during the early days of the postmodern movement. I actually was in a group of students that had breakfast with Michel Foucault, the great thinker of...
Really?
Yeah.
Where was that?
That was at Dartmouth College. And
I envy you. You know,
at those days, it was such a sort of outre cool way of looking at the world. But over the decades, it migrated into all fields and as a kind of a critique of the constitution of knowledge, really. The idea that these ideas really are, that facts can be objective, that people can, in good faith, debate and reach some kind of truth. Instead, everything is socially constructed. Everything's an artifact of power and oppression in some form.
Right. Well, they said, for example, the truth, knowledge, science, all of that, it's just power all the way down. And since, for example, white males have had the power, we should reverse that. People have written books about this, but the irony of those movements is that they saw themselves as liberatory left-wing movements, but the tools that they were inventing, the ideas and doctrines, turned out to be, you know, it's like inventing nuclear weapons. You have to be careful who gets them. And the right picked up on this stuff and some of the same arguments and said, well, you know, if it's power all the way down, then right now the mainstream media have the power and they're using it to dominate us and lie to us. So they create their alternative news network, and that gradually moves away from news toward conspiracy theories. And then along come people like Steve Bannon, who famously says that the way to deal with journalism, he says journalists are the real enemy. The way to deal with them is to, and I quote, flood the zone with shit. Oops. They pick up these tools and they use these tools. So they're now out there. We're just going to have to live with them for the indefinite future and figure out how to limit the damage.
So are you, in the end, optimistic?
I'm hopeful. And that's an important distinction. There have been earlier epistemic attacks and disruption. And it took a long time. And in the case of the printing press, it took about 100 to 150 years of savage warfare and the deaths of maybe 30% of the population of what's today's Germany.
You're talking about the Hundred Years' War in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Yeah, those were battles all across Europe between Catholics and Protestants, and often between Protestants. And we had far from deadly, but we had a real battle to build a fact-based media in America after the 19th century, which was, you know, just basically a sewer of extreme partisanship and fake news in the 19th century. When these new technologies and disruptors come along, you have to build new guidelines and guardrails. And you have to do that across society. And that's things like the Facebook Oversight Board, which I think is very promising. It's an effort to say, if they work in Facebook to make the place more attractive to users and more sustainable, then others may adopt them. That's how we turned around journalism. To journalists themselves becoming more savvy about disinformation and reporting on it. Civil society, groups like the ones I described earlier that are pushing back against cancel culture. Ordinary people becoming more cognizant that they're being manipulated by these tactics, that they're being taken in. So lots of changes. The tools that are being used here against the constitution of knowledge, they are intentional, they are sophisticated, they are powerful. We must understand them and we must organize to defend the system we have. And if we don't do that, yeah, they win.
You mentioned Facebook and the Facebook advisory or supervisory board. Is this one reason for hope that social media is now challenging itself and also facing challenges from outside?
Yeah, I think it is. 5 years ago, if you brought up these problems to social media executives, I say digital media because I want to include, you know, Google and search engines and stuff like that. They would typically say, you know, first of all, you can't prove it's a serious problem. And second, we're in the free speech business. This isn't our problem. Let the chips fall where they may. There's been a dawn of new understanding the last 5 years, as we've seen just how damaging to democracy disinformation is. And they're no longer saying that, whereas the best minds in digital media 5 years ago were poo-pooing the problem or saying it's not our problem. They now understand that this is a mortal threat to their business model. If your product is a sewer of unreliable information and harassment, then people will go away. They also understand the pressures on society from regulation, from their audiences, and from their own employees are not sustainable. So those good minds are now working on the problem. It's a wicked hard problem, but I think they're pointing the right direction. Twitter now, you know, it's a small thing, but these incentives can really change the way platforms operate. You know, now if you try to tweet out a link that you haven't read first, watch what happens. It'll intervene. It'll say, you sure you want to do that? And that's the right kind of thinking. That's what we do in science and journalism. When someone says, hey, Jim, this story you've written, are you sure? Have you checked this or that? Those are the incentives, the speed bumps along the way that help us to think, to consult others, to make sure we got the right answer.
Jonathan Rauch, author of The Constitution of Knowledge.
Richard, you told me before the show that you have a recommendation that might stump me. Some of our listeners might know that I used to be the editor of a movie magazine, although my knowledge of movies is anything but complete. But let me hear it. What's your recommendation for this week?
I'll be impressed if you've not only seen this film, but also remember it clearly. It's called The Leopard by the great Italian filmmaker Luchino Visconti.
Well, Visconti is certainly one of the greats. I do remember this movie. So tell us what you loved about it.
Yeah, it was filmed in 1963, and it is remarkably beautiful, literate, and lush. It runs more than 3 hours, but held both my wife and I in rapt attention. We rented it online for $4, and one of the great things about it is an extraordinary performance by Burt Lancaster, who plays a weary prince in 19th century Sicily, who's resigned to changing times and the nobility's diminished role in the new nation state of Italy.
Yes, and it also has Alain Delon, the great French actor, and Claudia Cardinale. I'm probably mangling both French and Italian in one sentence, but it's a wonderful example of why so many people in the 50s and 60s started turning to European cinema to get a kind of a nuance and richness that they weren't typically finding in American films of the era.
You've impressed me again, Jim, by remembering who is in the film.
There's nothing like Wikipedia, Richard.
The Constitution of Knowledge, Jim, for me, is one of those rare books that I think I'm going to remember for many, many years to come. It is brilliantly written and formulated, and even if you feel like you know all about disinformation campaigns and the assault on truth by former President Trump, there are some historical references that bring all of our concerns about the assault on democracy into focus.
Yeah, I think the really key thing to me about this book is right there in the subhead, a defense of truth. And the very idea that we can use a word like truth, that we can define it, that we can establish some processes to get closer to it, never perfect, always, you know, the search for truth, whether it's in journalism or science or in setting policy in society or law, it's always imperfect. But what I think is so important is these underlying ground rules, traditions, institutions that come down to us really from the Enlightenment. We've seen really deep challenges to all of these ideas that he celebrates in his book. So it's not a moment too soon to kind of man the barricades and defend these traditions that have allowed us to develop the kind of intellectual and moral infrastructure that holds our society together.
One of the things I love about Jonathan Rauch is he has a twinkle in his eye. And right at the end of the book, he has a great quote from Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote about the United States and traveled in the 1830s. And he said about this country, In America, the majority draws a formidable circle around thought. Within these limits, the writer is free, but woe to him if he dares go beyond them. There's always been this kind of rigid and earnest aspect to American thought.
You know, it's really frustrating that there isn't a lot of common ground or middle ground. And I think that the efforts to vilify the other side, whichever side you're on, it's taking the place of good faith efforts to say, okay, well, what set of facts can we agree on? I love that great old Senator Patrick Moynihan quote. He says, "We're all entitled to our own opinions. We're not entitled to our own facts. So let's celebrate facts and the institutions that help us locate them, discuss them, and really deal with them in an honest way."
It's How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And our show is a production of Davies Content. We make podcasts for companies and nonprofits. More at daviescontent.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.